Hello and welcome to CPR Podcast. My name is Chris Wangalwa. Our guest today is Henry Ndirangu, former Regional Communications Director at Aga Khan University Hospital. He has been an account director at Ogilvy Africa, Senior Manager External Communications at Safaricom, among other titles.
I actually started my career as a journalist. I went for an internship at Radio Africa, and after that it became a job as a journalist. And towards the last 3 years of my time at Radio Africa, I was a news editor. I knew that I didn't want to become a journalist beyond that, and that's how I joined Ogilvy.
It appears majority of the people I've met who are now in the public relations sector started off as journalists, and then they begin to have this feeling of, I think I belong to public relations more than journalism. I don't know why then people don't go to public relations school before they join PR. They prefer to go to journalism, or is it this thing of, you know, my parents have taken me to journalism, I had never heard of communications or PR, and here I am, I've studied it, I probably just want to upgrade over it and move on.
Yeah, it was fairly recently that I learned that public relations as a profession is not as old as, you know, you may imagine. And even teaching public relations, I think it's less than 50 years old in Kenya. That explains the progression that, you know, people start through journalism and go into PR. Also, in terms of skill set, PR is a lot of writing. And writing is nurtured through opportunities such as journalism. I would say that we struggled quite a bit with some of the interns who came in without journalism background, and they would struggle finding a style of writing for PR, and it wasn't the same for journalists.
PR is a lot of writing, you're right. Also, PR is a lot of creating. That's the other way to look at it.
Yes.
And so it just depends on what the strengths are or whether you can actually match them up. There's this thing about media relations that makes people want to onboard journalists more. And so PR has largely been looked at from that perspective of media relations.
Yes, media relations was a very critical component in our journey starting in PR around 2009. And I came to learn this, that I was coming from a very disadvantaged point of view, only having worked at one of the media houses and not a newspaper. So you'd hear of all these people who luckily we may have met or interacted with, but you've never had an opportunity to interact with them from this other perspective where you are seeking their support in running a story.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite different and interesting. But there is this thing that, you know, for my undergraduate, I studied PR.
It was a
program under School of Journalism at the University of Nairobi, then School of Journalism. And there was this thing that one of my former lecturers, late Peter Oriare, Dr. Peter Oriare, would say that a good PR practitioner needs to have the can-do-it attitude. It's something that stuck with me because the challenges that you get in PR are unusual. And you could choose to keep quiet and say, I have been unable to do X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could find out a way of doing it, either by consulting, trial and error, and you find that you can solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you solve one problem today, it means that that's your base for tomorrow.
Yeah.
You start from that base going higher and higher. That came in handy when I joined public relations. Joining public relations at Ogilvy was good. One, it's structured. There are people around you who you can ask questions. But also there was expectation that, you know, this is Ogilvy, we are mature public relations agency, this is how we do things. And so you are not expected to lower the standards.
Mm-hmm.
The client base was one that is justifiably demanding because maybe at the time you can see that the billing was quite attractive. And so we had to adhere to that high standard. The can-do-it attitude again came into my rescue because I behaved as per the expectations.
2 weeks ago, we were talking about your experience at Aga Khan and how you'd done these amazing things around digital transformation at Aga Khan. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take us through that?
Hospitals are very complex entities, and they become even more complex when you have a university attached to it. you look at, you know, all manner of things, right from the clinical to the operations to the financials. And the nature of financials in this case is quite complicated. You have insurance, you have cash, you have credit card, and all those things. There has been a thought for a very long time at Aga Khan University Hospital to change the system that they use to run the back-end systems. There has been a system that was in use, and somebody called it an orphan system because it had run out of the time that it was assigned, and it became kind of obsolete, managed very well by the IT team there, but it wasn't the most effective tool. And so there was a journey, more than 10-year-old journey, to introduce a new system, a new electronic health record system. And I was invited to be part of the journey, offering my communication support for that. In the 4 years that I was there, we ventured to do a few things that bring us together. One is that when I joined Aga Khan University, we were located in different buildings within Westlands and Parklands.
Okay.
So first, we can say that, you know, we didn't necessarily have a cohesive culture. And remember that Aga Khan University is quite, you know, has an international flavor, given that it's in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Pakistan, has presence in Afghanistan and the UK. You can imagine how much fragmented it was when different teams are sitting in different buildings.
Okay.
But 2 years ago, the university came, you know, to be under one roof. And through that, there has been a lot of work done. And it's under one roof opposite the hospital. Mm-hmm. So there has been a lot of cohesion created, with most of the work focusing initially on staff. Because, you know, you can imagine if you have been working at the hospital for 10 years, never had an interaction with the university, and now you're opposite each other, there are more opportunities for interaction. Then you start with staff, even as you start engaging your other external constituents and start building a cohesive culture, which I can say that quite now it's, you know, it's quite upbeat. Just to illustrate further is that I did many interviews there. And one of the things I started insisting is that I want to do the interview where you work.
Okay.
I don't want you to come to a predefined place. So if you work in the lab, mm-hmm. let's find a place within the lab that we can work with.
Okay.
If you work in a ward, let's show that. If you work at the casualty, accident and emergency, let's go to the back end of that and show that. And it's part of helping people come through the journey with you.
Do you want to take us through what change management means in a communication angle?
Yeah, change management is a concept that is taking root within many organizations, driven by many things. One is digital transformation. Another is the structure or the form of organizations is changing. And so there's need for change management. And I stumbled upon an opportunity for change management communication at Aga Khan, where we were implementing this digital transformation project. And you know that if change is pushed by the leadership, you will face a bit more resistance than if it is, you know, pushed at a peer level. And it's one of the areas that I have been able to work with experts in the field and see how to bring in communications to drive change within an organization. Here you step out of perhaps the realm of an ordinary communicator, and you're able to see things from management's eyes, but also keeping tabs on the reaction or the response of the ordinary people that you aim to touch with your communications. In this particular case, this digital transformation project, we didn't use most of the leaders to drive, you know, regular communications, but we identified subject matter experts within specific fields of the change project and were able to give them an opportunity to share. So it becomes this person X who you meet on the corridors. Perhaps you've never had an opportunity, but you get a chance to know that this is what they do. And the purpose was to stimulate conversations, even around, you know, lunchtime tables and stuff like that, or whenever you find yourself in a lift, that you can have a conversation with them and say, you know, please explain this bit to me. It was also an opportunity to show that this person does not just wear nice trousers and come to work, or a nice skirt and come to work. But this is the meaningful part that they play in this organization that is driving perhaps the biggest impact in change. And you know, it's a person like you and me. Towards the end, it gives a sense of belonging for all of us, a sense of appreciation among colleagues, and we are able to drive communication in a way that is different, because if we had used the leaders, we'd have found more apathy. When we went live with the project, there was a lot of work. It was the most stressful time for many people, leaders and staff alike. But at no point did anyone fall into despair or feel discouraged. People gave it their all. People spent less time at home. As we continue to settle in with the system, people have shared their numbers with perhaps someone you've worked with for many years but never had an interaction, and now you call each other on the regular because you're helping them settle with the system, or you're giving them guidance. So they're posing a good question, or they're driving an agenda similar to yours. So that level of interaction through effective change management, that there is cohesion within an organization, there is understanding and appreciation of the direction that the institution is taking, and there is ownership in the overall project uptake, was one of the things that I stumbled upon and perhaps has been the greatest learning in the recent years for me as a communicator. It reminds me of a line that I had a leader before in a different organization say that in 3 or 4 years, your work will not go away, but it will change significantly.
Yes.
So kit yourself for the new environment. Go back to school, learn these other things, find out how to work outside of your comfort zone, because the job will not go away, but the way it will change, even for us as communicators. Look at it this way. Before, the only content we'd create primarily would be a press release. Look at it now and look at the social media pages for all progressive organizations, and look at the role of a PR practitioner from that perspective, that you create content and place it on social media, amplify it if and when need be. That was not what we did 10 years ago. Again, when I started my career, crisis used to wait for a news cycle, wait for the 7 p.m. news, 9 p.m. news, tomorrow's newspaper. Not anymore. Crisis happens on the go, and we have had to learn as practitioners, how do you arrest the spread of false information? And one of the best case studies I think we saw in the recent times, was when Safaricom had a crisis, and instead of using traditional media, they used their social media channels, got their CEO to say that this is the challenge that we are facing, this is what we are doing to resolve it, this is the estimated time. And he came back later and said, we have been able to address it. This is what it was. This is what we've done. Something like that. Using their social media channels, and that information gets to
the mainstream.
Person X without waiting for an intermediary that the media used to play. It's a bit challenging now for the media, especially print journalists, to be able to keep it fresh for the second day.
That's the biggest challenge for any print journalist today.
Yes.
So I have this concept, and I'm a believer in the impossible. And I've always believed one way or another that I can see a crisis coming tomorrow. Is there a way that we can anticipate a crisis and be able to arrest it before it ever happens, that I can see next month on a certain day what's going to happen, and it won't happen because I already know it's a crisis coming?
One of the definitions of PR or communications has something that says a management function. And we find that many organizations relegate communications to a support role as opposed to having it in the mainstream. If there is a communications person in the mainstream, then they're able to pick out issues that are potentially going to lead to a crisis. And that's one of the ways in which we can anticipate and manage crisis beforehand. There are cases where, you know, like an accident, you can't anticipate. But you can anticipate that, you know, this news will be received in a certain way. If there is an action that you're going to take that doesn't resonate well with your audiences or doesn't look good for your institution, you can anticipate that this is going to be handled in a negative way. But if communications is relegated to a support role, chances are that you will be called upon one day on a Friday night and told, have you seen what people are saying on Twitter? By then, it's already too late. Had you been, as a communicator, seated at the table of men and women of repute within the organization, then you'd have been empowered to say that, you know, this looks bad. We either need to come up with a comprehensive communications plan for it, and it's within your capacity to guide the institution to start taking remedial action to avoid landing in the obvious pitfalls. And it's out of this that I observed that governments are not the most effective in communications. Maybe owing to their complexities, maybe owing to the silo mentality within government, that, you know, one hand does not trust the other. But one of the stark reminders that the government does not communicate well is a good case study that I hope someone can talk about, which is handing over of the Kenya Meat Commission to the military for refurbishment and great work that was done. My feelings are that we missed out on a big opportunity, or rather, a number of opportunities. One of them is to say that we are being honest as a government and this unit is not making us money, which is a statement of honesty, which breeds trust among the people that you speak to. Another opportunity that we lost is to showcase the capabilities within the military to be able to bring up some units within government back to life. And you look at the Kenya Meat Commission, I remember as a child, you know, corned beef was a treat. But as time went by, we didn't buy it. I have been working for a while. I'm a head of a household. I've never bought corned beef for my family. Okay. I don't know where that allure went. Ideally, we should have been giving our children a treat. The treat that we got, but somehow I never get, you know, to feel that attachment. And so that was another opportunity for the attachment or the association that I have with Kenya Meat Commission as a child being brought back to my life, and for me to look at it as, you know, some opportunities that I can use. And it just speaks to basically that we are not exploiting our communication capabilities. We do have many communication experts. I think the government has perhaps the bulk of them all within their ministries, departments, parastatals and all that. But are they empowered? Are they encouraged? Are they supported to be able to bring out good communications? Just to bring this to light, or better light, is that we learned about the refurbishment of the Kenya Meat Commission through a leaked memo that, you know, a lot of information now leaks through WhatsApp. So you see a leaked memo, and first you start looking at the Minister for Agriculture in bad light, negative light, yet he's just doing his duties, but he looks very suspicious. And you see here, we have on one hand opportunity to exploit, to position government, the military, and its departments positively. Then a leaked memo, which comes to erode.
What was the leaked memo saying?
I don't remember the very wording of it, but I remember to some extent it was an instruction or an order or a directive, and you know those words are used quite commonly in government, to illustrate that, you know, it's time for you to hand over this facility to the military for this refurbishment exercise. Nothing too kind.
I begin to have a feeling that there is need for a concept called communication activism. I don't know whether it even makes sense. Does it?
I think it does to some extent, that we need to fight for our space as communicators. It doesn't need to be an abrasive fight necessarily, but it needs to be a strategic fight. The bigger thing that we take out of this entire profession is to have that strategic fight where you're saying that I want to be in the know, I want to be at the table. For instance, when I say that I did an executive MBA, part of it was for me to be able to have a good conversation with perhaps the revered CFO within an organization and ask them, so what does this mean? We can't, and tell them that we can't go to town talking about EBITDA. That's accountants and finance talk. It doesn't make sense to everyone else. You can't purport to have communicated if you're talking about EBITDA. This is how you should be able to couch this information so that it makes sense to our audiences. And also to have a conversation of a similar nature with someone in IT, that they don't come to the fore and speak to themselves or speak to their 12 peers within the IT department and think that they have communicated very well. And there are organizations that have been very responsive to this strategic fight. And there is a difference in how they communicate vis-a-vis the ones who do not have. Talking of which, I'm at a point where I think that even B2B concept needs to be broken down further. That the fact that I do, for instance, say manufacturing, and my customers are businesses, but you need to remember that there are people like influencers, they are the payers, they are the users of these services who are not necessarily at the B2B table or B2B loop. They are somehow on the outside, and we need to loop them in. We need to make them feel that our products are superior or better. We also need to gain feedback or have a basis to gain feedback from the people who use, because if they start telling their customers that, you know, this boxes that we get from this supplier are like this or like that, it's not good. It's not good for our organization. It starts painting us negatively, and therefore we need to move away from thinking about business to business, but think of business to human, and in between there is need to create a relationship, and there must be an active and deliberate action in that respect. One of the ways to look at it is that communication, like many other functions within leadership, follow in the direction of the leader. And so if I'm a well-intentioned leader, but my communication skills are not the best, perhaps the rest of the organization follows in suit. You have good leaders who value communication, like the late Bob Collymore, and you found that Safaricom became a very communicative organization, comfortable enough to talk about people that it has dismissed because of things like fraud, when nobody else talked about it. Everyone wanted to hide such. Look at what comes out of it. Trust and such other positive attributes.
The fact that we can actually humanize an organization.
Yes. Kenyatta National Hospital is another good example of an organization that would perhaps benefit richly from communications. If you remember, the separation of the twins by local doctors was a hit all over the place. I'm sure that there are many good things that happen at Kenyatta National Hospital, but the reputation and the vibe that we get on an ongoing basis is not that. Mm-hmm. And this is how I look at it, that your first step towards managing crisis is avoiding it. Mm-hmm. And you avoid it by building your brand, mm-hmm. letting people know that this is what we stand for. These are our values. This is our behavior. These are our attributes. We are accessible. And these are the challenges that we also face on this other hand.
Yeah.
That if somebody comes and says, Chris has done this wrong thing, there are many people who know you and have interacted with you for a very long time who will say, that's unlike Chris.
No.
I'm not sure. That's not according to his brand. No. And therefore, even for institutions like Kenyatta, easy to attack. Mm-hmm. Easy mm-hmm. target any day. But had they been giving us more information on a regular basis and involving us in their journeys, then we will be more likely to accommodate them whenever they have a crisis. Identify with them. See if there are resource constraints, for instance. Why don't we pull together as maybe I belong to Rotary or any other formal grouping, and how can we lend our support to take Kenyatta to the next level? I think that's the direction that content is taking. And increasingly, if you stumble upon videos on YouTube, you will notice that there are many documentaries. One of the recent ones that I can remember watching was one by a company called Welt, a German company, and they would take us to the back end of the conversion of high-end Mercedes into a Brabus or something like that, you know, those high-end cars. Our affinity towards the car grows with such exposures.
Thank you very much, Henry Nirangu, for giving us the opportunity to speak with you.
This has been more provocative than I thought, and I'm happy to improve this profession that we so love.